Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Stuart Cunningham. I'm an emeritus professor at the Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia. I also work part-time for the University of Canberra, a small university in the nation's capital.
Well, Stuart, thanks a lot for being here. And we've just had a nice gossip for almost half an hour about all my problems, where Stuart, as ever, was both a keen and kind listening ear and a source of great advice in addition to that support. So
that's very nice of you, Toby. Thank you.
It's also true. And it's been true for since before the end of the Cold War. I have to admit. So, Prof, I wonder if we might begin by sharing with listeners the things or thing currently preoccupying, retarding, dynamizing, interesting you.
Well, that's an interesting way of starting. I'm a couple of years into a semi-enforced semi-retirement. I was not offered a new contract by my long-term employer, the Queensland University of Technology, at the start of COVID in 2020. And so over the last, so I've been in a transition stage in the last three and a bit years, during which I think the thing that that transition has given me is a sense of distance, sufficient distance from the university world to reflect with more personal relevance the question of relevance, I suppose, the relevance of cultural research, the relevance of research per se, what really matters beyond the walls of academe, that we academic scholars, researchers can really make a contribution to. That is something that I suppose I've been both known for and notorious for in insisting on at various stages in my academic career. But the given that that career has been somewhat truncated and somewhat fragmented in the last three and a half years, it's caused me to need to think that through that question in fresh ways.
The expression semi-enforced, semi-retirement is a very powerful one. There's so much connotation in it, and it's hard to work out what it means. But does it involve feeling sad?
Look, I didn't want that to happen in 2020. But on the other hand, it's naive of people like us, and I should say like me, perhaps not of you, given the trials and tribulations that you've faced in your career. It perhaps is naive of me to anthropomorphize institutions. Institutions are our entities that that need to make decisions. I've been a manager in one such institution for long enough to know that decisions have to be made, and a lot of things that happened in 2020 around the world were worst case scenario decisions. They were decisions based on that which looked apocalyptic in some respects at the time. I can understand why expensive people like me were offloaded. What I really don't and I am very sad about is the hundreds of thousands of those who are at the early stages of their careers or who were part-time casual labourers in the university systems, whose careers were far more savagely impacted than mine.
Well, thank you for that very honest, very frank response. Now, you mentioned being associated with the search for relevance in university research as being part of your ethos, as it were. You also suggested that your views on this have shifted somewhat in this period of semi-retirement. Could you tell us what your views were and what they are now?
Well, for me, the that which I'm mostly known for is the around the cultural, the so-called cultural policy moment or the cultural policy debate from the early 1990s that has in various ways moved on from that, but still remains a serious question. That was a moment, along with here in Australia, but elsewhere, colleagues such as Tony Bennett, Colin Mercer, Jennifer Craig at Griffith University, and me at that stage at Griffith, and then after spending a couple of years as outside the academy as a policy advisor at a not-for-profit community, it was a not-for-profit small outfit called the Communications Law Centre, which operated as a public advocacy mode to intervene in communications, culture, and media policy. So that experience for me was transformative in significant ways, and I then wrote a book called Framing Culture, Criticism and Policy in Australia, which basically argued a blunt argument, and that is that progressive left cultural criticism, for various reasons, has not so much been irrelevant, but at times been actively detrimental to the creation of good, what I would argue and argued at the time were progressive policy outcomes in cultural and communications policy. Now, mm-hmm. that was a bit of a, it's been called a bomb throwing book, and certainly would have been inconceivable to have written such a book not having had that experience, confronting and different experience of working within the policy machinery, seeking to shift it and to influence it. So that's what I am often known for. Later, became much more about the question of creative industries, and we might get onto that, but and the continuities and discontinuities between those two moments. But yes, that was where the question of the relevance of academic research and academic input into the wider public sphere crystallized for me very strongly. How it's changed, well, obviously, a lot of that debate, it certainly engendered a lot of heat, perhaps some light as well, and that has caused me to well, we're talking now up to 25 years ago. So the questions for me then moved on to a different kind of question, and that was how you got how you worked with small business to achieve a greater level of viability for small business enterprise, innovative small business enterprise in the creative, in the broader creative sector. And that to me has been the way in which I've approached the creative industries debate, which of course has, you know, is ongoing. And of course you have made significant contributions to. So there's been that kind of shift, obviously, from cultural policy to creative industries. If I cited Toby Miller on this, it would be a shift from progressive cultural policy thinking to neoliberal you know, a real neoliberal alignment. I see it as a as there being greater continuity than perhaps you have. I've seen it as a movement from working within the long march of the institutions to something more about backing the cultural and economic subalterns that get very little policy attention and that are subject to great volatility in, and around their viability. The turnover rate for small business in this field, as there is in general in small business, is very high. It's often engaged in by people who are marginal to spheres of influence, and I would certainly continue to defend that way of positioning the creative industries debate and my contribution to that debate.
And what about your views on this in the last 3 or 4 years? Because you indicated they have shifted, not necessarily on cultural policy and creative industries, but on the relevance of research.
Well, being, you know, not spending my days inside a university now. I mean, I work I work at distance from the place that currently employs me on a day or two a week basis. I'm 1,000 miles away from that place, literally. I'm a long way from the day-to-day life of the institute of institutions, and I look at it with a greater at a greater distance, and I think I'm I would like to think that the it's I'm still really formulating this, I suppose, in my own thinking, but I think that we require a much more, as I argued 25 years ago, a more programmatic sense of what we can do that is framed as where are the real points of contact with the people who you know, the broader taxpaying public, usually in public institutions, the careers of the students who pay fees to attend our classes and so on, to think from their positions, from their from their priorities. It's really about the relevance of what we do in public policy sense, in terms of career, the challenges of careers. Do we really know enough about where our students go, the variety, the challenges, the variety of outcomes for them, the pressures they face? How can we be much more aware of and open to that? I by and large, you know, if you're a career academic, you are inevitably bound up in institutional maintenance, system maintenance. But those who come and go through our system, that's where I think our focus should be to a greater extent.
And teaching brings me round to a point that I've been wondering about for some time, but don't have personal experience of. And it relates in part to what you said earlier about how, in terms of your own experiences of semi-enforced, semi-retirement, the fact that you're more worried for young people, younger people, whose careers have been thrown on the rocks as a consequence of the prevailing political economy of anxiety in universities. Because people such as ourselves learnt about academia and about communicating ideas in large part through teaching. Teaching large numbers of undergraduates, often not from the super elite. It seems to me that in some places, Australia being one of them, there, as part of the clawing back of block grants to universities and the redistribution of money by the federal government to competitive research contests and systems, and the creation of pathways for both senior and junior faculty, that there might be whole cohorts of people who've become full professors and may rarely, if ever, have taught 500 undergrads for years at a time in lectures, and that there may be senior people who haven't done so since the Cold War. Of course, we're in another one now. And that this disables precisely the kind of connection that you're talking about, the connection to students. Is that real, or have I just fantasized it?
Well, I'm one such person. Yes, I did. I did and vastly enjoyed and learnt enormously from the teaching environment that I worked in initially in my career. I was only a couple of years older than the people I taught in my first tranche of teaching, which goes back an inordinately long period of time to the late 1970s and into the 80s. And that was incredibly generative, partly because I was working in a university, Griffith University in Brisbane, that had opened its doors for the first time, a period of massive expansion of the university, massive in the sense that three or four universities opened across the country, completely greenfield universities, within some years of each other in that period, something inconceivable now. And this place, this institution, Griffith University, was a dedicated to interdisciplinary, thematic, problem-solving approaches to higher education, not the old disciplines, not the old faculties. That was extraordinarily challenging and extraordinarily generative, working as a 21-year-old with people who'd come back into the system to make a contribution teaching with anthropologists, with well-known literary critics, with within the philosophers. So the School of Humanities was this thematically based, educationally radical place. Very few people have had that kind of opportunity to be shaped and molded and challenged as a very, very recent, fresh out of undergraduate life. So teaching, I will always honour the opportunities it gives both to the giver as well as the receiver. My later half of my career was completely different. It was as a research professor working on leading, for example, a multi-institutional center of excellence funded by the National Research Funding Agency with very high expectations for impact internationally, working with colleagues, both well senior and also junior to me across 7 or 8 different universities, plus a range of international links and contacts, and industry and government connections. The whole question of humanities at scale, we were one of the early progenitors of the argument that you needed scale to address some of the key questions that the humanities raised. At the time, influential leaders were of the view, academic leaders were of the view that was the province of science, and that humanities scholars do their best work in the, you know, with the quill late at night as they cogitate and write their books. Now, you know, that was a pretty radical situation to be in, because I was leading a group of people who were claiming that they were making a contribution to a more dynamic and inclusive national innovation system. That was the rationale that I'd come up with. I'd come up with as for why the taxpayer should fund a group of predominantly humanities, but also social scientists and information technologists around the contribution of the creative industries to national innovation. So nothing like that could be accomplished simply through cogitation and the dark night of the soul with the quill and ink.
And returning to your early days, you mentioned doing a lot of teaching of people who were barely younger than you and sometimes older. You've had a very international career, and your education took place in 3 different countries. So I wonder if you could reflect a wee bit on going to grad school in Canada and then the US, because although this is quite a while ago, those experiences gave you an orientation that very few people have had, namely the experience of education in a variety of different countries. Many more people nowadays have had it, but many fewer in those days.
Well, yes, I mean, in those days, and we're talking we're talking about the 70s now, this was fairly unusual, although obviously the the connections between Australia as a British colonial settler society. The connections were almost always with Britain. I looked to extend my or to undertake graduate studies in Britain, but it was the early years of Thatcher, and Thatcher had raised the fees to an unsustainable level for me, and that then became unviable. I got a I won a scholarship from my undergraduate university, the University of Queensland, called the Captain James Cook Travelling Scholarship. And if anyone listening knows a little about Captain James Cook was the Englishman who undertook extensive cartography of the Pacific and sailed up the east coast of Australia in 1770, and named a number of places along the way. And so the Captain James Cook Travelling Scholarship was for people who n were about to study or who wanted to study disciplines that really didn't exist or had were very underdeveloped in Australia. So yeah, that's a very clear example of an opportunity that wouldn't exist now. And that enabled me, having not been able to afford Britain, to go to Canada, to McGill in Montreal, and to spend a year there in a Canadian communication school, a very well established and famous Canadian communication school, which founded by Donald Robinson, Robertson, who and that year was again highly generative. I was regarded as a rather strange person because I began and completed a master's degree in 9 months, and there were people there in the graduate program who'd been in there for a decade and hadn't completed a degree, which to I mean doesn't mean anything in the sense that they had other important things to do in their life, but I was kind of in and out before anyone kind of noticed in some ways, and because what had happened was that my interest in film and media first put in put first experienced at Griffith with studying or sorry teaching with teaching in teams with people like Jonathan Dawson and Ian Hunter, who Jonathan Dawson, someone who had worked at the public broadcaster in Australia extensively, you know, again, someone who had no academic background but who brought a wealth of industry experience, and Ian Hunter, a brilliant young theorist who was on the run from a leavesite English school. And so film and media became something that I really wanted to study. McGill had given me the beginnings of it, but then I decided that I wanted to go to an actual film school, and I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where David Bordwell was the main figure that I was attracted to, and that led me to a couple of years at in the Midwest. Getting to ABD, all but dissertation, but needing to go home, and I ultimately completed my PhD on an Australian filmmaker, Charles Chauvel, at Griffith in my second tranche of teaching there in the early to mid 1980s.
And Prof. Stewart, I wonder if we could focus for a moment on the three theses that you wrote before we return to your later publishing endeavors, because these are things that you've recently written about as providing both continuities and discontinuities with your later work. So your undergrad dissertation on Sylvia Plath, one of your graduate dissertations on Frederick Wiseman, and the other one, your doctorate, subsequently became a book that you've mentioned on Charles Chauvel. So I wondered if you could reflect on that trajectory, which, as I say, you've already written about fairly recently, in terms of continuities and discontinuities.
Well, thank you for that, Dorothy Dixer, as they call it in parliamentary language in Australia. That is a question that a very open question that feeds to something that I had suggested that we talk about, Toby, and that is to really say, well, when I was farewelled at QUT in 2020, I gave a talk that as one tries to do, I suppose, is to reflect on what kind of coherence, what kind of trajectory, what I called the project, Stuart Cunningham's project, in the singular, at the time. And I argued there that the linchpin was thinking non-linearly about this for a moment, that the linchpin was that period in my career where I led this centre of excellence that I've previously spoken about, the Centre of Excellence for Creative Industries and Innovation, driven by the argument, driven by the proposition that the humanities and the communication and media studies, as a particular component of that, have a great deal to contribute to a more dynamic and inclusive innovation, national innovation system. I see that as a fulcrum, but looking tipping backwards from that, I looked. I described or constructed my early academic career as having a set of links around innovation, textual innovation, aesthetic innovation, Sylvia Plath, a poet who I was absolutely awestruck by her later work. As many people have. I mean, obviously, there's a sort of cultic approach to Sylvia Plath. I've recently read the massive biography of Sylvia Plath by Heather Clark called Red Comet, The Short Life and Blazing Art of Sylvia Plath, came out last year, I believe. But when I was writing about her, barely 10 years after she had killed herself in 1963, what I was trying to come to terms with was this extraordinary innovation that meant that a woman poet, I could only really think that Emily Dickinson had any similarity to what she had achieved. So there we were. When I was in Canada and racing some kind of internal time clock that I really didn't understand, but I had this burning desire to do this degree quickly, in my master's at McGill. I lighted on Frederick Wiseman. Frederick Wiseman's Cinema Verite, a cinema direct, proponent extraordinaire, documentary work that had no voice of God, that had no seeming, except at the level of editing, structured authorial voice. It was observational documentary cinema, but powerful examinations of American institutions. His Titicut Follies, an examination of a mental institution in Massachusetts, his home state, was banned. His examination of an animal research, a research institution that were using live animals as on with ex experimenting on live animals was an almost unwatchable documentary that caused significant or generated provoked significant policy reform around experimentation on animals and so on. Wiseman's documentary Irv was incredibly innovative and you would have to say has been rarely equaled since. And so coming to my PhD on Charles Chauvel was a I wrote a an industrial biography inspired by David Bordwell's work but really trying to go further in some ways in linking the textual peculiarities of Chauvel's work which and its industrial and cultural roots. I coined a very ugly term, locationism, to try to capture the degree to which he wanted to capture in a documentary sense the land he loved, the histories that motivated him in Australian, particularly Australian colonial and more recent histories. But he did it in a way that combined a very strong documentary impulse with a very strong melodramatic impulse. And that trying to work that through, that was a very, very difficult. It took me a long time, but once I got it, it was that wonderful feeling of gestalt that you're actually onto something, you know, that you'd done the work, and that the last 6 months of my PhD, which took years, the last 6 months was like almost nothing else in my career. I was flying intellectually, and it was all coming together. But it was wrapped up in a bow with a bow by Toby Miller, who gave me the title for the book from which grew out of the PhD featuring Australia. So thank you, Toby. You're the one who gave me that title.
And in addition to those travels, and one can see a connection between them, you were a very significant poet. And I wonder if you could take us back, as they say in baseball commentary, to those times. And what were some of the poetic influences on you? Did they include Plath, for example?
Well, of course, yeah. I certainly wouldn't call myself a significant poet, and that's almost ludicrous to say that. I haven't been actively writing as a poet for decades, but I did for a period of time there publish two very small books, and I suppose my the high point of my poetic career was getting a poem published in Poetry Australia, which was the leading poetry magazine in the country in the early 1980s, and being edited by Les Murray, which Les Murray is Australia's greatest living poet, and he made a very small change to a poem that absolutely was apt, and I will never forget that. Apart from the fact that he had a reputation for throwing things in the bin, both metaphorically and physically, as an editor. So to get through that, and so that's wonderful. So no, the poetry was obviously personally important, and it was, but of course, perhaps best summed up by our colleague Noel King, who said in a piece in interview with me some years ago, everyone's got their favourite period of Cunningham's career, and it's always something before the present. I think that sums that up very well.
Yes, not only colleague but beloved friend Noel King, and probably one of the people that brought you and me together, that enabled us to meet. So I had a couple more questions for you, Prof. S, if I may, after which I'd like to invite you to...
I want to actually interrupt for a minute and say, if this isn't too self-indulgent, but it's wonderful to be speaking with you on your podcast, Toby, and I've got to say that I first met you as an interviewee, as an interviewer, and you as an interviewee for a job at Griffith University. And you weren't offered the job initially because apparently there was someone better than you. And I felt strongly enough as a member of this panel that I issued a dissenting opinion, as one did at that time. But what happened was that person number one turned the job down, and you were offered it, and therefore I have always felt that I was somewhat ahead of the curve in recognizing you as what you have subsequently become.
So what I'd like to do is ask a couple more questions and then throw to you to add anything you might wish to what we've said. That might take the form of commenting on issues we raised or introducing things that haven't been discussed. Yeah. So the first of my last two questions, and thank you for the kind story, is you've mentioned the I word, innovation, a few times, and also the expression national innovation system. These are concepts that in a sense might be self-evident to some, but not to many of us. So what's innovation and what's a national innovation system? That's my first question.
So I suppose to put this in very personal terms, in the early 2000s, I was happily working away on the idea that, if you like, intramural changes within the humanities around the its emphasis on popular the breakthrough emphases on popular culture, on new media, on the new media of the time, etc. And that they're the sorts of things that humanities scholars in the cultural communication and media sectors would recognize readily, I believe. But what it there was a sort of aha moment or a wake up to yourself moment when it became clear to me that all of this was it didn't matter it, what was where the real action was, where the real public policy emphasis was all around science, was all around the so-called STEM field, science, technology, engineering, and maths or medicine, STEM with a double M or STEM with a single M. And that governments were of a mind to see that those contributions as being absolutely where money for innovation, money for change, money for new industries, money to support new horizons, sunrise industries. These were the kinds of terms of the period, and my kind of gestalt moment was: we need to be part of that. We need to be in there, and so that led me to a long process of educating myself and being educated by others about where innovation could be, where the idea of a national innovation system was part and parcel of STEM thinking and of policy in Europe, in the North American systems, very well known, and were being developed here in Australia, very much to the exclusion of anything that the humanities, arts, and even most of the social sciences, the so-called HAS sector, so HAS and STEM, the HAS sector was a bit part player at best. So innovation is new ideas successfully applied. That's the simplest way of defining it. And so I set out firstly, through looking at the ways in which social science was positioning itself in this, and of course business and business management were very much in there. I connected up with people who were developing these ideas in the federal bureaucracy, and we worked together on major papers. I connected with a major figure in the field, Terry Cutler, as business business management of telecommunications. He became the chair of the Center of Excellence that I directed. And he, and I suppose the high point here was that he chaired a review of the National Innovation System in Australia in 2007-2008, while he was one of his other jobs was chairing the Centre of Excellence for Creative Industries and Innovation. So, you know, there's a long story there, and of course I wrote a book called Hidden Innovation. That sought to capture that whole argument and context and reflect on its ongoing relevance for the broader humanities and communication, media and cultural studies going forward.
Many thanks. And my last question for you prior to inviting you to add anything you wish is to inquire about what have been in the past and are at the moment the major theoretical and political influences on you.
I think the most of this most of this work that I've described has been driven by a notion of social democratic reformist politics. I have positioned myself in that space and sought to differentiate myself from what I have described in some of my writings as universal and abstract revolutionary language of left academia. I am aware that that's to create a kind of binary that is probably unhelpful, particularly for those who are encountering it for the first time. But the base on which I make those distinctions is an attempt to focus what, to go back to the original points that I made at the start, what is our relevance? Where can we make our best contributions? What can we do as teachers, as scholars, as researchers, to make sure that our work is of relevance to the broader public, that at least in public institutions pays our way, but also to those who pay to come and sit at the feet of scholars in the humanities. So social democratic reformist politics, some of the work that has inspired me, René Girard has been a very important thinker as someone who identified the mimetic drive, the origins of violence in human societies. I was introduced to Girard by Richard Herskowitz when I was a student at Wisconsin-Madison. That was very important for me, and I was going to write a PhD on Girard and New Hollywood cinema, but having lost the context, that is American graduate school, and not being able to imagine how that work could ever be done under the tutelage of those who were in charge of the school, the film school at the time, I didn't do it, and instead I went a different way. But he's remained an important figure for me. I think that the ways in which the creative industries debate's been important for me in terms of the degree to really try to come to terms with the critique of creative industries. Obviously, very well put by figures. Obviously, you, Toby, Philip Schlesinger, Dave O'Brien, David Hesman-Halge, Kate Oakley, etc., I take very seriously and have sought to engage. But I'm also I'm interested in the cultural economy people. I think that David Stark's work, Sense of Dissonance, obviously, but his references are very much to the, you know, the French school, that cultural economy draws on. They've been very important for me. Poltansky and Cibolito, New Spirit of Capitalism, these kinds of cultural economies have been important. I think the idea that, of course, the economy exists, you know, the idea of the economy, this is what this work is so important about, the idea of the economy, which I've been accused of fetishizing reducing, minimizing culture for economy, etc. But the economy exists in a much vaster field of social and cultural life, and the cultural economy school has been important for me in bolstering my thinking in that area, in those broad areas that creative industries has thrown up, the nature of capitalism, the connections between culture, society, and economy. There are very big questions that subtend all debate around the creative industries. Obviously, I was very influenced by Schumpeter's work when asked to give one book in a special issue of Cultural Studies, I believe it was, the most influential book. I gave Schumpeter's Capitalism, Socialism and Democracy as my book. So that's a bit of a wander around intellectual influences, Toby.
Many thanks. And to bring things to a finale, I wonder if there are things that you'd like to add to what we've said.
Well, I don't want to press on people's patience, and including yours. Look, I think that what I'd like to, I suppose, say in conclusion is that I appreciate your work in this podcast of bringing together a vast range of people who've got a great variety of interests, but through the mechanism of this podcast have created some I think a coherent space within which a really interesting and engaging range of issues have been contemplated, and outside of formal academic discourse, you know, in journals and books, it's just wonderful that the podcast medium is a long form medium, but it's an informal medium, and that's down to you. So thank you, Toby.
Well, thank you, Stuart. It's been wonderful as always to chat with you.
Thank you.